Well, I'm John Beck, and I co-direct our Daily Work of Daily Lives with my colleague Kurt Dewhurst here from the museum. Kurt and Marsha are on their way back from Johannesburg, which is why they're not in the audience today. But we are working on next year's schedule, and I can tell you that it's already forming up nicely. My favorite one so far, LaShawn Harris from the History Department here, is going to be taking us through a infamous murder case in Virginia where a laundress killed her boss. And it really looks at the whole notion of race, class, gender, labor in progressive era America. It's a 1912 case. That one will be fun to watch. That and many of the others next year are going to be part of our celebration of 6050, which is our year-long exploration, conversation, celebration, and commemoration of the 60th anniversary of Brown versus School Board and the 50th anniversary of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It's a year-long conversation here on the MSU campus and in the community, really looking at issues of civil rights and human rights. So we'll have a number of them in the fall that will be flying underneath of the 6050 banner. I also need to say that we're also going to have a push for a nighttime lecture series called Labor Rights Are Human Rights, which will be coordinated with the campus unions here at Michigan State University. So some upcoming things. We have two more brown bags after today in the series before we have the summer hiatus and get fired up for the fall. And my wonderful assistant, Bill Greenwood, will now start handing things over. So coming up on April 4th, Jean-Philippe Mathieu from the University of Quebec will be here to talk about what to me is one of the most interesting periods in American history and also in Canadian history. It's labor struggle in the United States and Canada, 1876 through 1878, Reflections on Connected Histories. For those who might know or not know that history, the 1877 rail strikes are probably what I often call and had said to students was the second American Revolution. Started in Martinsburg, West Virginia, ultimately went all the way to San Francisco. It was a general strike, not only in rail, but in other transportation industries and in a variety of other industries. I mean, it's a fabulous, very interesting kind of history, and Jean-Philippe is going to help us understand that in relation to both Canada and the U.S. 10 days later, Matt Daly, who spoke in our Brown Bag series before, is coming back this time to talk about maritime. So he's going to be doing a talk in the wake of disaster, the Lake Carriers Association Welfare Capitalism and Lake Erie's Black Friday Storm of 1916. So Matt's a wonderful historian, very dynamic historian, working very strongly with his students and everything else. I would have you also, if you can post, it's a part of the Library Colloquia series, and they did a very nice flyer for it as well. So if there's some place that you can put those up, those are coming around. Which brings me to today's brown bag. And Colin Bossen, of course, is a favorite son of many people in this audience, some of them literally. And, oh, I forgot to do the other thing, which is to, and yes, Bill can become Vanna as well. Here it comes. Howard Boss and Colin's father and I just finished, well, we edited, and now it's just fresh off the press, our book, Detroit Resurgent. And this book involves the photographs and interviews done by Gilles Perrin and Nicole Avencic, and they laid out a lot of that at their brown bag here. And so this is kind of a walk through memory lane for those of you who were at that brown bag, but we commend it to you. It's a great Christmas gift, but buy it here at the museum when you do. Yeah. So I've been looking forward to this presentation for some time. Colin is currently in the PhD program in American Studies at Harvard University. He's an ordained minister. He actually preached twice on Sunday here while he was in town with his parents. I'm looking forward to bringing him back for the next presentation that he does a few years from now once the dissertation is done, because he's interested in the industrial workers of the world and the Ku Klux Klan as two different expressions of a populist moment in America after the turn of the 20th century. I think that's a real interesting topic, and I look forward to having Colin back to talk about that. But today he's talking about an earlier piece, which was actually published in Working USA, one of the premier journals within the whole labor movement and labor studies. And there are some copies available if anybody would like one. And his topic today, he's going to give a slightly different version that's in the that's in front of you if you read the printed version, is called The Chicago Couriers Union, 2003 to 2010, A Case Study in Solidarity Unionism. I've been looking forward to having Colin back in town. So do me a favor and join me in welcoming to our daily work our daily lives.
Well, before I begin, I'd like to thank John and Michigan State University for bringing me out here. It's nice to be back in East Lansing and see so many familiar faces. On a cold afternoon in March 2005, almost 20 bike messengers from Arrow Messenger Service in Chicago turned off their two-way radios and gathered together in the city's Loop District. They stayed there for 2 hours, conducting a work stoppage and preventing the same-day delivery service they worked for from being able to deliver packages to its clients. The work stoppage was the product of more than a year of organizing by bike messengers affiliated with the Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW. It led to a wage increase for the workers and helped to establish the Chicago Couriers Union as a presence in Chicago's messenger industry. The purpose and structure of my talk this afternoon is twofold. First, I tell the story of a largely unknown chapter in contemporary labor history, the successful organization of a local union with a radical ideology amongst couriers of Chicago. Second, I critique the theory of solidarity unionism, an organizing methodology used to organize the CCU and articulated by historian and social activist Staunton Lind that relies on direct action rather than legal recognition to win workplace demands. I speak as someone who is intimately involved in organizing the union. From late 2003 until the summer of 2005, I served as a volunteer organizer with it. While this talk covers the history of the CCU through 2010, it focuses most heavily on the period of my own involvement, a period from which lessons about the union and union organizing can be drawn. Organizing for the CCU began in the autumn at the autumn 2003 meeting of the Chicago branch of the IWW. At the time, the branch did not represent workers anywhere, and members were eager to change this. We thought we might be able to do so by organizing a union within the courier industry using this model of solidarity unionism.
Excuse me, could you speak either more slowly or more loudly?
Sure. Although no one in the IWW knew it at the time, members of the Chicago bike messenger community were shopping around for a union. In June 2003, there had been an effort to create a Windy City Bike Messengers Association, or WCBMA. The effort was led in part by Andrea Murphy and was the third attempt to create a bike messenger association in the city. Under Murphy's guidance, the first act of the WCBMA was to invite Sam Smucker, an organizer affiliated with the AFL-CIO, to meet with messengers and explain to them the process of forming a union. Here's Murphy's account of the meeting with Smucker. Approximately 40 people showed up to the union question and answer session. Smucker pointed out the logistical difficulties of organizing the courier industry and explained that before even talking to any union in particular, we would have to map the industry inside and out and build a very strong community. Only then would it be appropriate to shop around for a union. The way he put it, the task sounded almost impossible. He offered minimal guidance at best. And we wondered why, after doing all this work, we would want to hand over whatever to whichever union was bold enough to take on the challenging bike messenger industry, our organization, and pay hefty monthly dues. The initial purpose of the WCBMA had been to tackle on-the-job issues. And after meeting with Smucker, this focus was eventually lost. As the WCBMA began to unravel, the IWW stepped into the space that it left behind. Conversations between the remnants of the WCBMA and the IWW resulted in the decision to bring IWW member and former bike messenger Little Pete from Portland to Chicago for a week. Pete had been one of the primary organizers at Transerve, an Oregon courier company, where the IWW waged a campaign from 2000 to 2002 that won significant workplace gains. Plans for his time in Chicago included meetings with small groups of messengers to discuss organizing with the IWW and a public forum on the IWW's experience in the courier industry in Portland. After a word-of-mouth publicity campaign, more than 40 people attended the forum held in mid-December 2003. During the meeting, it was clear that there was both excitement and fear about the possibility of forming a union. Some grievances began to emerge. In particular, several workers expressed anger about being independent contractors rather than employees. Several of those present expressed fear about losing their jobs for attending the meeting. At the meeting, Pete made several of the same points that Smucker had made. He argued that the first two tasks of organizing a union were to develop a social map of the industry and gather a contact list for as many workers as possible. During this phase of the campaign, Pete suggested it was best to organize quietly and not attract management's attention. The forum ended with a plan to hold another informational meeting. In the meantime, participants at the forum were asked to complete a questionnaire on the company they worked for and the demographics of its workforce. They were asked to bring completed questionnaires to the next meeting. It was at this point that my own story intersected with the messenger community. I had joined the IWW in 1999 when I lived in San Francisco and moved to Chicago in 2003 to attend seminary. So shortly after the campaign started, my friend MK prompted me to join the organizing committee. My first task for the campaign was to facilitate the second large informational meeting. Attendance was not as high as it had been at the previous meeting, but it exceeded 20 people. Few of the surveys from the forum were returned. Instead of focusing on mapping the industry and gathering contacts, attendees at the meeting wanted to discuss their working conditions and what could be done about them immediately. Bikers at Aero Messenger Service felt targeted because the company had recently instituted a policy requiring them to cover their tattoos and piercings. The IWW organizers at the meeting did not believe that launching a strike, as the messengers wanted to do, would meet with success. Instead, we encouraged them to build an infrastructure that would make the winning of future gains possible. The meeting ended without agreement on further action. Afterwards, the IWW organizing committee decided to enter into a period of quiet organizing. The committee consisted at this point of only MK and myself, neither of whom worked in the industry. MK, Pete, and I decided that we would seek funds from the union's general executive board to bring Pete to Chicago for 10 weeks to kickstart the campaign. We reasoned that the courier campaign had potential, but without Pete, we lacked experience to run it. Our request for funds was granted, and it was agreed that Pete would come to Chicago from late March to mid-June for 10 weeks. During that time, he would focus his energies on teaching workers how to organize, handle grievances, and strategize about the union effort. While we waited for Pete to arrive, things began to get hot over at Aero. A few of the messengers wanted to strike over the new tattoo and piercing policy. They invited MK and me to attend a meeting where they discussed what to do. We talked them out of striking, reasoning that they did not have the support or organization to win their demands. After talking them out of striking, and in the process alienating several of them, MK and I began the task of building an organizing committee. We selected a group of four workers as its first members. We had chosen them because they were leaders within the Messenger community. All four of them were white, and one of the first tasks of the group was to increase its racial diversity. We wanted to represent the demographics that existed within the industry. At the time, about 50% of the couriers in Chicago were black. We realized that we would not be able to organize a union successfully if it did not reflect the makeup of the industry. We also developed a larger strategy for the campaign. It came from Pete's experience in Portland, the theory of solidarity unionism, and studying the industrial union structures of the 1920s and 1930s. We planned to organize two layers of committees. The first were shop committees made up of members of the union who worked at individual companies. These committees were to handle grievances that arose at individual workplaces. Each shop committee would elect a member to serve on an industrial-wide organizing committee, or IOC, that would handle grievances that could only be dealt with on an industry-wide basis. The hope was once the union became strong enough, the IOC would be able to issue a set of industry-wide demands and then work to meet these demands through militant direct action. Pete returned to Chicago in late March, and we began to implement our strategy. Through diligent work in his absence, we had managed to create an almost complete map of the industry. In the spring of 2004, we knew the precise demographics of the courier workforce, how many people worked at each of Chicago's 20 or more bike messenger companies, and the total number of bike, walk, driver, and walker messengers. We had contact information for almost 650 of Chicago's 1,500 messengers. With Pete in town, we were able to capitalize on this information and organize several shop committees. However, these committees were not capable of functioning without an outside organizer present. Despite this limitation, the shop committees began to build the union slowly by winning small grievances at individual workplaces. Our first victory came when Scott Gibson, one of the members of the IOC, was fined illegally when he was caught not wearing a company-required uniform. Gibson only found out about the fine when he noticed a $50 deduction from his paycheck. After discovering the deduction, Gibson and the shop committee at Standard Courier, where he worked, developed an action plan and confronted management. They demanded that the company's uniform policy be overturned and that Gibson be reimbursed the money he was fined. Management insisted that messengers were independent contractors. If this was true, the shop committee reasoned, Standard could not require messengers to wear uniforms. Over the course of a week and a half, Gibson and six of his coworkers marched in on their boss three times to issue their demands. After the third march, management did three things. They rescinded the uniform policy, they refunded Scott the $50 they had fined him, and then they fired him. Scott's firing turned out to have a silver lining. The same day he was fired, he filed an unfair labor practice charging that Standard punished him for union activity. Several months later, Standard decided to settle the charge and offer Scott $3,000. More importantly, Scott filed a claim with the Illinois Department of Employment Securities. The claim resulted in a decision that Standard's workers are employees and not independent contractors, as the company has claimed. This helped us convince couriers at other companies that they were employees and not independent contractors. This, in turn, inspired them to assert their rights as employees in several situations and later provided lawyers affiliated with the campaign the basis for workplace compensation claims. During Pete's time in Chicago, we held two organizer trainings, a program started by the IWW in 2000 to give workers on the job the tools and skills to organize their workplaces. The trainings provided messengers with the basic information they needed to organize, but did not seem to provide them with the confidence to be independent organizers. I speculate that MK, Pete, and I served as a crutch, and that with us to rely on, the messengers did not need to develop their own leadership. Pete left Chicago in June 2004, and his absence was immediately felt. MK and I lacked his experience, and the organizing began to falter. In an effort to expand it, we decided to aggressively reach out to driver messengers. Up until this point, participation in the union had consisted entirely of bike messengers. Just as we knew that we needed to bring African-American bike messengers into the organizing, we also knew that we had to bring driver messengers into the campaign. Unfortunately, while we were successful in the first instance, at this point, at least half of the membership of the IOC was African-American. We were not successful in the second. The workplace culture of driver messengers is different from that of bike messengers. Driver messengers form an isolated and atomized workforce. Bike messengers congregate together during their downtime. When they stand by, that is, wait for a call from their dispatcher, bike messengers talk and spend social time together. Driver messengers, in contrast, spend most of their downtime in their cars. While bike messengers can be found together outside of work at bars and bike races, it is rare for driver messengers to socialize with either each other or with bike messengers. We developed a survey about working conditions as a pretext to gather drivers' contact information and clarify our understanding of their grievances. The organizing committee surveyed over 100 drivers in person, over the telephone, and in their homes, but we were not able to bring any of them into the campaign. Toward the end of summer 2004, MK took a job with Arrow as a bike messenger. He began to focus his energy more and more on building a shop committee at Arrow. We spent much of the autumn and winter trying to get members of the IOC to focus on building shop committees, but were unable to establish a functioning committee at any shop other than Arrow. I spent months working with workers from two mid-sized companies, but in both cases, neither committee developed to the point where it was able to take on a worker's grievance and win. Meanwhile, Gibson and Murphy resurrected the WCBMA as an industry-wide grievance committee. They sought out messengers who had complaints and tried to help them solve grievances. In two instances, the WCBMA was able to get workers their final paychecks when the companies they worked for threatened not to pay them after they quit their jobs. The strategy that they followed in these instances was to meet with the worker in question, write a letter to the company on the worker's behalf notifying the company that they knew about its failure to pay the final paycheck, and threaten to contact the Illinois Department of Labor. These efforts were successful at getting the workers their pay, but they were not successful in building a grievance committee. While this group struggled, MK worked to build a shop committee at Arrow. His efforts paid off, and within a few months, the shop committee grew to include almost all of the bike messengers at the company, close to 20 people, and began to fight for a company-wide pay increase. The struggle is chronicled in an unpublished account by Tim Stello, a former Arrow messenger. By late January, nearly all of Arrow's bike messengers were attending weekly meetings. On February 4th, an unsigned letter was submitted to Phyllis Applebaum, Arrow's owner. It stated that the industry commission standard for each package delivered is based on an even split between employer and employee, and that Arrow's flat rate is well below that standard. Since Arrow had not given its employees a raise in a decade, it should consider its flat rate, raising its flat rate to meet the industry standard. Within a few days, Applebaum requested a meeting with bike messenger Steve Waters. She told him that she wasn't even going to discuss the issues presented in the letter, and that she was going to throw it in the garbage can. On the afternoon of March 9th, bike messengers Chris Odehall and Steve Waters met with Applebaum, who again said the company couldn't afford a raise. Since Arrow had a fairly consistent turnover with employees, Odehall suggested implementing a hiring freeze, a move that would boost morale and productivity by allowing individual messengers to deliver more packages, but also lessen employee expense. Applebaum responded by telling Odehall, "That doesn't matter. The company cannot afford a raise. If you want a better job, go work at McDonald's." If you want a better job, go work at McDonald's. That evening, after hashing out a number of ideas, the group decided on a solution. The next day, the messengers went into action, and early in the afternoon, all but two of the bike messengers switched off their radio. A 2-hour work stoppage had begun. As the bikers gathered together in Chicago's Loop, the message they were sending to management was clear. Management would either negotiate or tell clients they couldn't meet deadlines. Shortly afterwards, the messengers returned to Arrow's dispatch center only to discover that the police were waiting for them. They were now locked out. A conversation between Waters and the police quickly led to the police's departure. Then two of the bikers met with Applebaum and other members of Arrow's management and restated their demands. After the work stoppage, messengers decided that now that they had shown management they were serious, they would continue to build pressure on the company through a variety of direct actions. As Stello relates, they stopped delivering house runs or orders placed by Arrow that paid a flat rate of $2 per job, no matter where in the city they were supposed to go. They stopped delivering cash calls or orders placed by non-Arrow customers that paid a similarly low rate. And because of overhiring and long standby times, they created the standby log, a form that calculated the amount of time the bikers spent standing by. Next to these total calculation, there was a line that stated, total amount of compensation for today's standby, $0. Applebaum began complaining about the influx of logs and eventually gave bikers the option of leaving early if it was slow. While this wasn't exactly a win for better pay, it was a sign that she was willing to negotiate. She then made the company's first proposal. A hiring freeze would be implemented, house account runs would be paid according to the regular rate table, cash calls would increase by $2, and each messenger with more than 2 years consecutive experience would receive a 25-cent raise on each delivery. The two-year rule was clearly intended to split the bikers, and a few days later, on April 21st, two of the bikers met with Applebaum and told her that the group would accept everything but the two-year rule. She refused to budge and demanded that if the bikers wanted to accept her offer, they would have to provide a letter pledging to refrain from future negotiations or direct action. They decided that her offer was unacceptable and planned a no uniform day. On May 2nd, 20 bikers showed up to work without the company's uniform. Management responded by suspending all of them on the spot. This shut down the company's bike board. The suspensions were the opening phase in a campaign of harassment that included Applebaum's son calling in each biker, no matter where in the city they were working, twice on two consecutive days for uniform inspections. Two bikers were fired. The union responded by filing a series of unfair labor practices. For several weeks, the negotiations stalled until the bikers again threatened direct action. They sent a letter to Applebaum stating that unless their demands were met, they would bring their campaign to the attention of Arrow's clients and the media. The threat was too much for the company. Arrow called an employee meeting during which Applebaum called the group's activities illegal and unprotected, before conceding that the following Monday, all previously mentioned wage increases would be implemented, a formal signed concession for future direct action wouldn't be required, and unexpectedly, the pay increases would extend to Arrow's approximately 80 drivers. The pay increases were the first such increases at the company for non-office personnel in close to a decade. The actions at Arrow left the union in the strongest place it had been since its inception. It also caused a shift in the strategy for organizing. During the efforts at Arrow, it had been decided to dissolve the IOC. Soon afterwards, I left Chicago, and the union hired Andrea Murphy to work as a full-time organizer. After the experience with Little Pete, it was decided that having a full-time organizer for the campaign would build momentum. The money to pay for Murphy came from both the General Executive Board of the IWW and a series of local fundraising efforts. By her own admission, the time she spent as an organizer was marked both with successes and failures. She did not feel empowered to do her job and came into conflict with MK. By the time she started with the union, the organizing had fallen to somewhat of a low point. The organization that had existed at Arrow had deteriorated in the combined wake of a victory without plans for a next step and continued harassment of union members. Murphy decided that it was time to end the secrecy that had surrounded the campaign since the decision was made to enter into a period of quiet organizing in early 2004. With the Aero strike, it was safe to assume that management at the various messenger companies knew the union existed. She believed that the only thing that efforts to keep the campaign under the radar was accomplishing was alienating workers. The campaign began a new open phase, and the newly born Chicago Couriers Union was formed. Murphy's hope was that every messenger would feel welcome at CCU meetings. At the union's first meeting, it was decided that every working messenger would have a voice and a vote at meetings, with the exception that only members in good standing could vote on money matters. The CCU elected a secretary, Marshall Arnold, a dispatcher who'd been fired for union organizing at Aero and was now working at another company, and it began to hold biweekly meetings. The group began to organize around grievances and industry issues. They also held workshops and advocated for messengers with the city. Murphy left the position of paid organizer in Chicago in December 2005. When I interviewed Marshall in the autumn of 2007 about her tenure with the union and the union's current status, he said she had helped to create its existing structure. Over the next several years, workers used that structure to do a variety of things. 2006 was typical. In that year, the union held informational pickets around independent contractor issues, organized two bike messenger races, settled a grievance for a messenger whose check had been withheld, began a campaign to install a messenger center in a prominent building in the Loop, sent five messengers to attend the IWW's General Assembly in Oakland, and held numerous social events. In 2008, the CCU hosted the North American Cycle Courier Championships. The event attracted hundreds of bike messengers from North America, Europe, Japan, and elsewhere to socialize and compete with other messengers in races. The CCU used the opportunity to try to form the IWW Industrial Union North American Organizing Committee, NORAM, dedicated to bring new cities on board its union organizing campaign and boost efforts in areas where there was already a union presence. NORAM's first effort was to hold a labor forum that was attended by more than 40 messengers from cities across the country. This helped spur union activity and group confrontations with bosses in Philadelphia and Los Angeles. Unfortunately, none of these activities were enough to keep the momentum of the CCU going. Changes in technology and an economic downturn led to a dramatic decrease in the number of people working in Chicago's courier industry. The population of bike messengers went from several hundred to under 100. So even though it developed an orientation program and manual for new messengers, the CCU saw a decline in membership in 2009. In 2010, the union's activity reached a low point. While it retained several members in the industry, regular meetings ceased, and the union's officers and assets merged with the Chicago IWW branch. The initial intention of the organizers of the CCU was to organize couriers using the model of union organizing articulated by Staunton Lind, known as solidarity unionism. In his book, Solidarity Unionism, Lind defines it as relying on not technical expertise or the numbers of signed up members, nor a bureaucratic chain of command, but the spark that leaps from person to person, especially in times of common crisis. Lind's solidarity unionism has six basic characteristics. Membership is voluntary. There is no dues checkoff. There are no paid officers or staff. It is democratic, with all participants empowered to criticize frankly and fully. It relies on direct action rather than collective bargaining agreements. And it is intentional and international in orientation and seeks to build networks of workers across boundaries of gender, nation, and religious faith. Lind contrasts solidarity unionism with what he calls the business unionism of the large AFL-CIO and Change to Win unions. Three characteristics that he identifies as inherent in business unions are, first, they are government-sponsored monopolies that try to force all persons working in a particular shop to join the union and seek to deduct dues from that worker's paycheck. Second, they agree to collective bargaining agreements containing, on the one hand, a management prerogative clause that enables management to utilize or to unilaterally make the crucial investment decisions about whether a plant will stay open how profits are to be invested, and so on. And on the other hand, a no-strike clause prohibiting direct action of all forms during the life of a contract. Third, they seek to undermine and prevent the formation of independent labor parties locally and nationally. Elsewhere, he adds that such unions are organized from top down, devoted to labor peace, and reliant on paid staff who generally remove workers from the grievance and decision-making processes. Lin's theory draws from the work of two of his mentors, Stan Weir and Martin Glaberman. Weir and Glaberman were both working-class intellectuals who wrote extensively about the structural problems of the American labor movement. Weir spent much of his life as a sailor, a longshoreman, and an auto worker in California. Glaberman was an auto worker in Detroit. Glaberman's work focused on problems, on the problem inherent in union contractualism. Specifically, he examined how labor contracts could turn the union into an entity that disciplined workers rather than represented their interests. While contracts allowed the codifications of gains made by the union during times of struggle, they also give union officials a part in the enforcing of discipline among union members. Glaberman had a second insight about the working class, union struggles, and social movements. He believed that activity precedes consciousness, that workers respond to workplace situations emotionally before they respond rationally. As a result, they often take actions in ways that contradict their presupposed beliefs, and in the cases of unions, contractual agreements. Weir complimented Glaberman through his writings on the informal work group. Reflecting on his time in the Merchant Marine, Weir writes, "At first I thought that merchant seamen were more militant because they traveled and read a lot. But later I came to see that the informal social groups that develop on a ship at sea are in the main created by the formal and informal division of labor which operates the ship. That is, informal and formal work groups are identical, so the social and technological powers of the seamen are merged, thus revealing to them the importance of their role and enlarging the consciousness of their strength. Informal work groups, the social groups that people form at work, were for Weir the heart of the union. Each of these social groups has its own culture, informal leadership, discipline, and activity. If one does not understand these groups, the individuals who comprise them, and their culture, then organizing anything on the shop floor is out of the question. Even though the initial organizers of the CCU hoped to build a union using the solidarity unionism model, our organizing did not follow the model exactly. The union was initiated by a group of outside organizers working in collaboration with workers in the industry rather than starting from the spark that leaps from person to person. Partially because of this, the union on two occasions had two temporarily paid organizers. Additionally, the CCU had the resources, limited though they were, of the larger IWW behind it. It was able to draw on trainings conducted by members of the union from outside Chicago. Our deviations from the model of solidarity unionism put forth by Lind and our commitment to using solidarity unionism as a model for organizing mean that the experience of organizing the CCU provides me with the opportunity to critique solidarity unionism in action. My first critique of solidarity unionism as it relates to the CCU is something I have already mentioned. A campaign initiated by outside organizers cannot follow the pure and simple model of solidarity unionism. As outsiders, there were times when the IWW organizers found themselves in conflict with the desires of those in the industry. In some instances, these conflicts stifled workers and possibly held back the progression of the campaign. The initiation of the couriers union by outsiders may have also stifled the development of leadership for the courier union from within the messenger industry. The organizers' trainings that took part in Chicago did not initially inspire the workers who participated to take leadership roles in the campaign. In addition, a pattern was established whereby union members looked towards outsiders or paid organizers for guidance. This observation raises serious questions for solidarity unionism. Is it possible to develop a union along its lines with organizers who come from initially outside the industry? If not, then how are solidarity unionists to initiate new unions? simply wait for the spark that leaps from person to person. With union membership at an all-time low in the United States, that hardly seems like the best strategy for rebuilding the labor movement. Without the involvement of outside organizers, it is doubtful that the CCU would have been launched at all. Second, solidarity unionism undervalues the importance of institutions and labor organizing. The CCU was only able to succeed because of the institutional support it received. The larger IWW helped pay for organizers, provided infrastructure in the form of the local branches, union hall, and bank account, gave the union legal standing with the National Labor Relations Board, connected the union with legal counsel, held organizer trainings, and published flyers and distributed information about the union. This undervaluing of unions creates the illusion that solidarity unions appear spontaneously. Solidarity unionism at Starbucks, a recent pamphlet co-authored by Lind and Daniel Gross, co-founder of the IWW-affiliated Starbucks Workers Union, makes no mention of the numerous trainings that union members have attended across the country. According to Adam Welch, a member of the IWW's Organizer Training Committee from 2003 to 2007, these trainings have been an important part and played an important role in expanding the union beyond its base in New York and helping workers learn how to build a union using solidarity unionism. In an interview, Welch also noted that in the Starbucks campaign and with the IWW efforts to organize at Jimmy John's gourmet sandwiches in the Twin Cities, many of the initial organizers salted into shops with the intention of organizing. In his view, the campaigns would probably have never gotten started without these salts. Given the experience of MK at Aero, this makes me further wonder how often workers will initiate activities that lead to successful organizing campaigns and how often they need to be pushed by outside organizers. Third, informal work groups are important when organizing a solidarity union. The CCU was most successful when it organized around informal work groups and least successful when it organized outside of them. The union was able to racially integrate because blacks and whites belonged to the same informal work groups. The union was not able to bring drivers in, partially because they belonged to a different set of informal work groups than the bike messengers. Efforts to create the IOC and the shop committees often failed because such structures did not follow the logic of informal work groups. The open membership the CCU ultimately adopted was more successful because it reflected the social dynamics of bike messenger culture. The key social unit for bike messengers is not the company, but the whole community of bike messengers. It was only by creating an organization that reflected this that the CCU was able to succeed in building a larger membership. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, solidarity unionism's critique of contractualism and emphasis on the importance of informal work groups makes it a good fit for organizing in industries like the courier industry, with high densities of independent contractors and workforces segregated by trade or location. The union was able to win gains at Aero and resolve grievances at other companies without ever participating in an NLRB-supervised election or having a contract with an employer. If the union had focused on winning union elections before addressing workplace concerns, it is doubtful that it would have been able to accomplish what it did. In 1993, for example, workers at the courier company Deadline Express won a union election, but the union was unable to successfully negotiate a contract and the union dissolved. And in Portland, Oregon, the IWW's efforts fell apart when, after successfully winning several gains through the use of direct action, the union failed to win an election because the NLRB decided the bargaining unit consisted of more than just the departments in which the union had strength. The CCU, in contrast, raised industry standards and advocated for workers in situations such as fighting building bans, which might not have been covered by a union contract. My experience with the CCU has convinced me that solidarity unionism provides a useful strategy for rebuilding the labor movement. With few resources and a commitment to solidarity, CCU members were able to come together and win substantive gains that improved their working lives. That they needed some outside assistance to do so suggests that in order for solidarity unionism to reach its potential, the theory needs to be adjusted to include roles for radical institutions and outside organizers. Lind has lamented that IWW theory has not progressed beyond the 1905 preamble. Solitary comrades like the late Marty Glaberman and Stan Weir have had to try to do the theoretical work that the IWW should have done. My own work is one small effort to help IWW theory and solidarity unionism progress, and in doing so, build a stronger radical labor movement. It's my hope that it will spark other critical efforts. Thank you very much.
Well, luckily we have all sorts of time to be able to have comments and questions on this, so let me open it up. Somebody want to jump in?
Just maybe two questions to start off. How sustainable do you think a model based on solidarity unionism is, since it's mainly based on direct action and not as much or not on collective bargaining agreements? Mm-hmm. And then the second one, do you see any lessons from what you studied, for example, for the organizing that is going on in the fast food sector?
So I guess to answer the first question, I think it really opens up some pretty interesting questions about what a union is and how it functions, because since the IWW started to adopt this model of organizing, it's grown pretty significantly. I mean, for a small radical union, but I mean, we have 2,000 to 2,500 members now, which is at the largest point since the late 1940s. And what I've seen is that people will join the union through their workplace, in a workplace, in a campaign, and then as they move on to their next workplace, if they happen to be engaged by the IWW, carry their union membership with them, and then oftentimes start organizing in that new workplace. So it seems to be building networks of people, rather than sort of a permanent presence at any particular workplace. So I've, for instance, seen people in the food and retail industry in Portland who have been organizing now there for like 10 years, work at five or six different grocery stores, and in each case build a committee of like, you know, 10 or 15 people over that time that's been able to improve the conditions of that grocery store. But then when they move on to another workplace or something, that organization will often follow apart, but they'll bring two or three of those people sort of permanently into the organization. So I'm not really certain about, like, in terms of long-term density of a particular industry, what's going to happen. But I think that it's also a very young model at this moment, and most of the people who have been trying to practice it are still in their, like, late 20s, and I think that we're going to see, we're going to have to see kind of how that, you know, plays out. But I'm encouraged that what we'll see is people, we'll continue to see this pattern of people engaging and then taking it with them rather than leaving their union membership and politics, workplace politics behind when they move on to a new workplace. I mean, as for the fight for 15, I don't really know whether it was influenced by solidarity unionism or not. It seems like they've adopted a lot of the strategies that particularly people from the Jimmy John's campaign in the Twin Cities used. So it's hard for me to really kind of answer that question without having access to conversations that I'm not part of. But it does seem, it seems in similar, if not inspired by, you know, so.
Before Renee jumps in with this question, let me just say that many of you are smelling I call the office in Essen to send somebody out to check if the smell is coming out from below. The shop is right below us, two floors down, so I'm not sure if we're getting, you know, a chemical smell from there or what we're getting. Just to tell you this, you know, hopefully we're not all going to die. We have an inability to form future use. Let me take it over to Renee.
While you were making your presentation, I was just wondering, would it be possible to form these unions without this outside help, so on, outsiders coming in and sustaining the movement. And if you are able to organize the union from inside, what is it that's required for this to happen?
That's a really big question that I don't really know I have like the answer to. I can take some guesses. I think certainly we see instances of, and we've seen plenty of instances of workers self-organizing unions of all kinds from the inside. I think that the question right now is that sort of given the real low point the American labor movement is at, is like whether that's a pattern that will happen a lot of. I mean, in Boston right now, actually, what has happened is there was a group of workers at a company called Insomnia Cookies, which is like a chain, local chain of cookie places that makes, you know, there's like 30 stores across the country, and they make cookies late at night for people, and then they have a delivery service. So these workers self-organized and then contacted the Boston branch of the IWW to help them sort of represent them and kind of take it further. And I've seen a number of instances like that happen, both with IWW and with other unions over the years. So I think that for that to really happen, though, there needs to be sort of more of a public discourse about the labor movement, and people need to know that labor unions exist and that there are people that they can call and maybe not get the same reaction that they got from the guy, Sam Smucker, who the messengers met with initially. Yeah, so as in terms of what's it going to take, I mean, I think that I think that there needs to really be more of a development of worker militancy, and I'm not really certain where that's going to come from. I mean, I would say that one of the things that's happened in the last 25 years in this country has been, as we've seen the decline of the unions, a lot of the sort of radicals who had been active in the unions in the 30s and 40s have died off and were not successful for various reasons in reproducing the kind of militancy that they had earlier. And I think that unless we have sort of another generation of people sort of who are learning how to be workplace militants and kind of spreading across different workplaces in the country, I don't really see much of anything happening.
Let me jump in just to find a question. Depends on how you define success.
That's true.
Using this case study, the workers were able to force management to receive certain demands. Well, do you say then that if the organization disappears, you know, the next day, that it's a failure? And the answer is no, that in temporally it was a success. If we say that the only way to understand success is long-range, long-term organizational formats, then it's a failure.
Right.
Right? So that's a very, very large question, Renee, especially when you're looking at this issue of whether or not you can take a group out on strike, for example, and win a specific demand. I think I was going to bring up the story. In 1933, right after the NIRA was passed, somebody called President Green of the AFL, and they said, we'd like an organizer, please. And Green says, well, we're a little busy right now, but you know what it takes to organize. We're going to bring an organizer down. We're going to ultimately, you know, try to get you together, whatever, and maybe take you out on strike. And the guy said, Mr. Green, 10,000 of us are already on strike at Memphis Barge Works. We simply need an organizer, which is to your point.
Right.
And so in that way, workers can have often not and have done significant bits of self-organization. The difference is a lot of that, the IWW, when it was formed, there was no legality. The legal frame was that worker self-organization was by its very nature illegal, okay, for the most part. Now that we have legality, the good news is that we have a frame to work in, which they did. The problem is that the frame not only frees, it constrains.
right? I mean, that's really, mm-hmm. I think, the argument that you would make, Tom.
Sure.
Is that following legality by its very nature says that you have to walk certain ways.
Well, and I would sort of go a little bit further than that and say that at this point, management really has the playbook for what those plays are for the most part, and that therefore, to use a fancy social science term, we need to expand the repertoire of contention. We need to really push out what are the possibilities so that management really cannot predict what's going to happen, what the playbook that's going to be followed. Because I would say that the big problem has been that there's been a certain playbook, management knows it by heart, and so if you're only playing by the same playbook that somebody else knows, you're not going to win very often.
Right.
I'm struck by, you were summarizing some conditions that maybe facilitated some that did the opposite. And if you're organizing courier and bike couriers, I'm assuming those are probably ranging in age from like 18 to 30 for the most part, young. And people don't grow up and say, Daddy, when I grow up, I'm going to make a bike courier for my career. So it's a stage in life and usually not a lifetime career. So people may think very differently about the nature of the work, and there's going to be a lot of turnover, natural turnover from aging in that group. Whereas you could be a lifelong plumber,
right,
electrician. And so it's a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, actually, one of the things that I learned in Chicago was that there was a huge racial dimension to that. So you would have 60-year-old African-American bike messengers who had been bike messengers for 30 years. But other than this guy, Steve Waters, who I mentioned, that was not true of any of the white folk. And so you had this really, sort of weird dynamic in the demographics of the industry where you had all these African-American guys who were old enough to be the parents or maybe even the grandparents of their younger white coworkers, who were really often in it because it was like a cool lifestyle as opposed to it was like the only job that they could have and maintain. But I think to your other point about the huge turnover, I think that that is a real issue, and I think it's a real issue that the labor movement needs to confront across the board, because as we see this growth of the service sector and the decline of a lot of the jobs that have been sort of traditionally middle class, I think that we are seeing that sort of turnover happen at, in lots of different places. And people who didn't ever expect that they were going to be, working at Starbucks for 10 years now in that position. I mean, I know people who have college degrees who have been now working at Starbucks for 5 or 6 years.
Was not something that happened very often, just saying 20 years ago.
Right.
So there's potential, if this is a facilitating factor for organizing, that people see themselves to be in a particular occupation, maybe with steps up the ladder, mm-hmm. In terms of responsibility. They see that as happening for a longer period of time. They might actually be more likely to work. Mm-hmm. Plus, it gives the union itself, memory.
Right.
That helps.
You want to.
Should be positive.
Right. And I think that some of that is what we've seen with this Fight for 15 campaign that SEIU and folks are supporting, is that they've realized that there really is this group of people who are in the fast food industry for a long time, maybe life, and therefore they have more of a commitment to it than somebody who thinks that I'm going to work there for the summer. So.
Raise with you. So what the law does is the law demands that you stipulate what the bargaining unit is. So that if you look at turnover as an issue, if you really think labor the way I think Colin is trying to, then you have to say, if you say to workers, we will follow you wherever you go as your union, that's a different notion than saying you have to work here,
right,
to be a member of a union. So that if you look at turnover not necessarily as a problem for the labor movement, but as a possibility of reimagining the way that we organize,
say that you are a member, and the IWW has done this, because they're really saying, your car, we will follow you wherever you go, and wherever you go, you have a possibility of organizing the future workforce, right? So, but the scripture, and Colin, you know, when we stipulate a bargaining unit, that's where management often plays a very, very pivotal role in terms of squelching in the organization. Because they can say, we're going to keep people out who are pro-union, or we're going to include a whole group of people who are anti-union for the purpose of stipulating a unit. And that's that stricture of legality in terms of how legalism automatically kind of really reigns on the parade of workers and self-organization.
So, ideal situation, you have people who are going to be in a certain line of work for a full career. They and people who share that line of work are organized as a unit of bargaining wherever they go in their career. Then you have perhaps optimal characteristics. I mean, on the other hand, I was a candidate member of two unions, a retail clerks union. The very first time I got a bag boy job in California, I was in the union. They guaranteed my $1.30 an hour wage. When I don't have a permanent car or whatever, maybe they got my little 770 still has it somewhere, but that existed for essentially. Most bad boys were very temporary workers. But it was there. Now, starting from scratch, and I'm guessing that union may still be around in LA, I don't know. But that probably helped. I got overtime, whatever, over 40 hours and so on. But I think in general, that's probably not the case for people who are in temp jobs or staging career jobs is not, they don't view it. So they're just not going to be receptive. They're also going to be very replaceable by 15-year-olds coming into the...
Sure. I mean, and I think that one thing that I've learned in my own experience as an organizer is that you don't really need to focus on a majority of the workplace, though, to like organize a successful organization. And I think that this is one difference that the IWW, or the Solidarity Unionism model, has kind of with the more normal NRLB election route, is that rather than trying to organize all of the workers in the workplace, you're really just trying to organize, I mean, like, that would be great, but you can do an awful lot with, like, not very many people who are committed and organized. So it's really about trying to figure out who those people are, how to bring them together, and then figuring out what networks within the sort of workplace they can, tap into. I mean, I was involved in helping organize the strike that shut down the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach in May of 2006. And we had an organizing committee of 50 people. And, you know, it was like a one-day big event. But on that one day, we took out 20,000 people with a 50-person organizing committee. So I think that, you know, it's really, you can really accomplish a lot with just sort of trying to find the people who are going to be leaders within the shop and who are going to be there for a while and who other people respect. I mean, I have a lot of criticisms about, like, overly focusing on that, but I don't really kind of want to get into like that level of nuance right now.
Other questions that folks have? Questions or comments? One thing I would, challenge on this.
Okay.
What's often said about the business unit's model is it gives predictability, and that actually workers like predictability. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, solidarity unionism is really based on the idea that we should be involved in perpetual class war and struggle, right? So do workers really want perpetual class war and struggle?
Well, no. On the other hand, I think that it also depends a little bit on like their particular, people want stability, I mean, I think for the most part, right? I mean, I think that that is like a significant critique and why, in terms of my own criticism of solidarity unionism, I really feel like there needs to be a strong upplaying of the importance of institutions in building a model. I mean, that's actually, I think, where a lot of my own work has fallen in the last several years, is really trying to think about what are sort of institutions that can sustain the possibility for that class struggle, even if it's not present in a particular workplace or people don't want to be involved in that conflict and organizing all the time. Because as you know, organizing is exhausting work. And you know, certainly I don't want to be organizing my coworkers every day all the time. But on the other hand, I think it is true that there is often a conflict simmering there between management and labor. And you know, how are we going to kind of reach that equilibrium point, or is that possible? So no, I think that it's a very valid criticism. I think that somebody needs to figure out how to bridge the stability that the business union model offers and the sort of possibility for expanding the repertoire of contention that solidarity unionism offers, and maybe we'll get somewhere.
Well, with that, oh, yes, okay, here we go,
Sorry, this is a difficult question. Do you think that raising minimum wage has been done in some states and cities, and now that there's would be seen as a victory for labor, because I see it as a partial rehabilitation of the image of the labor movement, because I think they're often discounted because they're unnecessary now.
So it's unions?
Unions, they're unnecessary.
I mean, I think it would be a victory for work. I mean, I think that the level that they're talking about raising the minimum wage to in the state of Massachusetts right now is to $14 an hour. And I feel like if that happens, that's a victory for working people, whether or not it's like a victory for big labor or small labor or whomever. And I just would like to see it happen. I don't know. I don't know whether people would perceive it. I think it would be a victory for the Democratic Party. And I think that it would probably be a victory for those parts of the AFL-CIO and Change to Win leadership that are part of the Democratic Party. Whether it would be perceived by sort of people across the country as a victory for labor, I kind of doubt it, because I don't really see that narrative being like one within the sort of public realm.
Well, what I'm getting at, there's one reason I think that labor can't recruit people into or whatever, mm-hmm. is because people argue we don't need them now because working conditions have improved because of labor's work in the past. And this points out that there are a lot of laboring people whose wages aren't affording them a livelihood. So that could be used to say, you know what, they haven't worked for a lot of people.
Well, but you know, also I would push back a little bit on that, because I don't remember the statistics, but lots of people want to join unions that don't have them. I mean, you might be able to recite those numbers off the top of your head, but
over half of the people who polled would join a union if they could. The problem is that the legal understanding of how exactly that all works actually goes to foil union organization. Much of the time, because of the way that it's mm-hmm. that it's put together. One way, and I love Colin's comment, what you're bringing out, many of us, including me, often say that the difference is in 1964, with the rise of the 64 Civil Rights Act, you saw a major change in America between people who said, if you want workplace justice, get a union, to if you want workplace justice, get a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a huge sea change in the way. Now, that's looking back, however, that unions started declining in 1955 after the AFL-CIO merger. I mean, we just saw a steady decline in overall rates of unionization. Now, I would argue that that's one part of it. So if you raise a minimum wage, what you're really saying is that legislation can get you what a collective bargaining agreement very well may not. I mean, that would be the argument that can be made. That, well, let's always go to the legislature because they can deliver and unions cannot. Oddly enough, when you see unions negotiating concession agreements where they're getting less wages or two-tiered wages for young workers versus old workers, that's the kind of argument right?
Yeah.
Then you would argue common.
Yeah.
Well, but then should laws be changed? I mean, you said we have specific rules now about how to form a union in a workplace that are governed by law.
Right, exactly.
Should those laws expand?
I mean, that I don't want to get into the history of labor law, but there have been a number of labor acts after the 1934 Act that have progressively constricted what workers can do. And for a long time, one of the things that people have sort of suggested needs to happen is those acts need to be repealed, and we need to get back to what was sort of the original form of the National Labor Relations Act. I don't think that that's going to happen without some sort of massive groundswell. But, you know.
Lane Kirkland at one point, just to give you the history, Lane Kirkland, who was the most conservative president of the AFL-CIO probably ever, said at one point, off microphone, he said, well, maybe what we should really do is just throw out all the laws. Now, I think he was saying that out of frustration, and he'd be the last person to advocate for it. But I think he was saying it out of frustration, given the fact that that is kind of the strictures and how they work. And we can always talk later about this.
Isn't the line kill all the lawyers?
What?
That, Brian, isn't that Shakespeare?
Yeah, well, we won't get Shakespearean, but we'll go over here to Neil. Yes.
You hinted a little bit on this, and I wonder to what extent in the organizing drive the cultural dimension played a part. And I mean beyond the workplace culture that you talked about,
yeah,
the couriers gathered together. You mentioned this in that you had this one segment, let's say 50% of which tended to be older African-American workers and these younger kids, the white couriers. And was there a cultural dimension beyond that which proved very difficult because in light of what we read about the failed UAW drive in Chattanooga to Volkswagen, at least, you know, the written stuff says that the cultural dimension was a big
I mean, we were really able to bridge that between the African-American workers and the white workers. The real issue was between the drivers and the bike messengers. I mean, I think it helped that we really aggressively recruited the sort of some of the older leadership within the African-American community and got them on board, and that they would then do things like have big barbecues on the south side of Chicago where the younger messengers, white messengers, would come to, and the older guys would bring their kids and their grandkids, and we'd have, you know, a really big party that brought people together. But we just were never able to do anything with the driver messengers. Like I said, we did over 100 phone calls and house visits and got, like, basically nothing, so.
Oh, I was just going to ask about the social element, because I think that's really important. And I know that the bikers hang out a lot of times in certain bars in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Was it cross-generational and racial?
It depended on the bar. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there was a bar on the south side of the loop that was interracial, and then there were bars on the north side of the loop that were not. So, you know, Chicago is a very stratified city, and, like, it kind of fell down just sort of like the city falls down. Subversive organization list.
So this has been a dream for me. Could you just briefly say some of the industries that IWW has been organizing?
So there's been, I mean, the most sort of sustainable organizing has happened within the retail and food service work. In Portland, Oregon, there's also been a pretty significant inroads into, like, social service work. So social service workers, I forget the numbers, but the social service workers branch out there has like 150 members, or has had as many. I don't know exactly where it's at right now. We've had some successful but unsustainable efforts at organizing truck drivers that have had some very dramatic strikes that have not succeeded in producing any sort of lasting institution. The courier industry, there's people who've been organizing in education as well, and then more recently efforts in healthcare that are promising, but probably not for a while. I mean, it's actually it's interesting. A number of these sort of young people who are in their early 20s, primarily from the Portland branch, who didn't have college educations, decided that they were going to get jobs as nurses, because that's where they thought like the cutting edge was going to be, healthcare. And so these guys who, and they're all men, who like grew up without, you know, a lot of them didn't even graduate high school, put themselves through community college, then put themselves through nursing school, and now are scattered at like, you know, four or five hospitals across the country doing organizing there. So that's the sort of thing that I think we might see something about 10 years from now rather than right now. But yeah.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Has this brought the IWW into conflict, or at least into relationship with these other unions,
I mean, my personal experience has been that a lot of the animosity that existed in like the 30s has just not been present, and that people have been incredibly supportive. We got some of the workers from this Insomnia Cookie got fired, and the largest strike donation that we got was from an SEIU local, and it was, you know, a couple of $1,000. So I think, you know, who knows, like, if the IWW were suddenly to get to the size of United Electrical Workers or something like that, who knows what would happen. But, and most of those relationships are very much with the locals rather than with the nationals, you know. But my personal feeling is that they're sort of both models. We're both part of the same movement. We need to push each other and try to, you know, move forward together, even though there's good reason to have historical animosity, to really try to figure out how we can revitalize the labor movement in the United States rather than fight amongst ourselves.
Well, with that, let us give Colin another round of applause.